to Matthew chapter 5. We'll be continuing our study of the Sermon on the Mount that we began a while ago, I guess it was now, and had a little bit of a break from, and trying to pick back up where we left off. We just finished the first section of the sermon, what is commonly referred to as the Beatitudes. And we'll be picking up this morning, or this evening, I suppose, in verse 13, looking at the section of text that comes next, where Jesus compares the citizen of God's kingdom to salt and light. And this section of text has been called, at least in one place that I've seen, it's been called the Similitudes. I guess that's kind of a playoff of Beatitudes by taking in the metaphorical aspect of what Jesus is doing here, that he's changing the style of teaching. And I guess technically speaking, these aren't really similes that Jesus is making here, but it still, I think, works as a decent title. And after all, if you were to base it on the more literal metaphor, it really wouldn't work as a title. Just Metaphitudes doesn't sound very good at all. It doesn't really roll off the tongue and have a nice ring to it. So I think we're going to be going with Similitudes, at least in as we're talking about this section of the text this evening. Let's go ahead and begin by reading what Jesus says here. He says, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." As Jesus continues in his sermon and says these things, the first thing I want to do is point out a couple of things that's going on as he is continuing in this sermon. The first thing that I would suggest that you see here is Jesus turns his focus to the Christian being salt to the world and light to the world is that there is a change in style of what Jesus is doing here. Up to this point in the sermon, Jesus has been simply describing the citizens of the kingdom of heaven. That's what this entire sermon is about. As you remember, as Matthew leads up to this text in chapter 4, it says that Jesus was going everywhere preaching the gospel of the kingdom. And then it is from that point on that he launches into this great discourse about what it really means to be in the kingdom of heaven. And that's what really is the underscoring point of this entire sermon, is it is a sermon about kingdom citizens and what it means to be a citizen in that kingdom. And up to this point, Jesus has been describing these citizens of God's kingdom by their personal traits. He's been going through what is basically plain teaching on moral characteristics. He's telling us about things like people who are to be meek, and people who are to have mercy, people who are poor in spirit and pure in heart. But now his teaching changes. It's no longer that this is the kind of character trait you are to have, basic teaching. Instead, he turns his focus to teaching by metaphor, by comparing the citizens of God's kingdom to things that were common to everyday life. First, he compares to salt, which we think of primarily as a seasoning agent, but in the ancient world it was primarily a preservative that was used to keep things from rotting. And then he compares the Christian to light. Again, I think something that we take for granted because it's just a flip of the switch away from us. But in the ancient world, something that was so important to chase away the evening gloom. What Jesus says here, in essence, is that because of sin in the world of man is putrefying in darkness. And the citizens of God's kingdom are to stand up against this world that is putrefying in the darkness. We are destined to be salt that would stop the rot of sin. We are to be light that will penetrate the dark despair of sin. And so Jesus teaches by metaphor in this section. And secondly, there's a change in perspective at this point in the sermon as well. Up to this point, the teaching that Jesus has been doing has really widened the gap between the citizen of God's kingdom and the world in which we live. it really is something of an underlying point through the entire sermon that we're different from everybody. And you see just how different we are to be as Jesus opens this sermon by talking about the citizens of God's kingdom being people who mourn over sin, people who are just spiritually bankrupt and realize it. They are meek. They don't follow the wisdom of the world. We're so different from the world around us. Our values are different from their values. Our wisdom is seen in folly and ultimately is culminated by a world persecuting these citizens of God's kingdom specifically because of their righteousness. It is an ever-widening gap. Yet Jesus here connects us back to the world. He says, you do have a relationship with the world. You're not just different from them. You can't live a kingdom life in a private way. And the righteousness that you live will attract attention. And he's already said that, really. He said the righteousness that you live, that's going to attract attention. And he's looked at it from the perspective of the effect that the world is going to have on the kingdom citizen. It will persecute you because of your righteousness. And now here Jesus turns the tables and says, you will also have an effect on the world because of the righteous life that you live. You will be salt to the earth. You will be light to the world. And there is something of an irony here, really. I guess you may call it something of an irony, maybe something of a surprise, perhaps is a better way of putting it. Here Jesus is speaking to this multitude that is following him. And it seems, as you read the text, like it is a large number of people, a great number of people who are following Jesus. But really, if you put it in context of the whole world, it's a relatively small group of people. Even the biggest crowds that ever followed Jesus, in the context of the world, it's a small group of people. It's just a handful, really, of poor, nondescript people on a Galilean hillside. And Jesus says to them, you are going to change the world. These people aren't even citizens of the world's dominant empire. They're not educated. They're not among the philosophical elite. These are the people who are going to change the world. How? By living a life that is counterintuitive? That's how they're going to change the world? But as history unfolds, what you see is that the Roman Empire collapses, Plato's Academy closes, the schools of the Stoics and the Epicureans, the philosophical elite of the day, they fade to a historical curiosity. The great library in Alexandria burns to the ground, and this small company of Christians endures. And here we are today. And just as these seem to be nobodies of the first century have changed the world, so Jesus demands our utmost effort as well. And we can change the world too if we are salt and light, as Jesus asks us to be. You see, what Jesus is saying here is the same thing that he says in so many other places, that we are to live in the world, but not of the world. But that means you can't live in isolation from the world. You can't sequester yourself away in a monastery somewhere. You must be in the world to have this kind of impact. And you see this in Jesus' life. He was always a man of the people. He was always walking with the people and talking to the people. We can't let the persecution that we will face dry up our compassion. We can't let the weariness that we will find in life turn us from the needs of other people. Yes, it is absolutely true that we are in a kingdom that does war with sin. Yet our kingdom must also be a refuge for the sinner. I've said many times before, and I'll probably be saying this for the rest of my life, the kingdom of God, the church, is not a place for holy people. It's a place for sinners. It's a place for people who want to be holy people, people who are striving to be holy people. Yet we cannot let ourselves grow up into such an image of pious holiness that sinners don't feel welcome among us. Because the reality is that's who we are. We are warring with sin, but but we must be a refuge for the sinner. Well, Jesus begins by saying, "You are the salt of the earth. If the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot." You are the salt of the world. Well, one of the things that this clearly tells us in the context of salt and how it was used in ancient culture is that the world is decaying. The world is rotting. The world is putrefying. If it's left to its own devices, if there is nothing that will stop that decay, the world will turn ever more rotten. Really, what you see unfolding constantly in the Bible is, if you can cast your mind back to high school physics, I guess it is, it's kind of the moral equivalent of the second law of thermodynamics. That things, if they're left on their own, they tend toward disorder. They tend toward entropy. They fall apart on their own. Things don't clean themselves up. Things don't organize themselves. It goes the other way. And the same thing is true in the moral world. That's what you see constantly through the Bible. God creates a perfect place, and what happens? People befoul it. God wipes everybody out and starts all over again. And what happens? People befoul it. God chooses one person to go create a special nation for himself. And how long does it take before sin is in that line as well? You get to a point of the judges where it says there's no king and everyone does what is right in their own eyes. And what happens? They constantly sin. They constantly are swept away and overrun by the enemy. And they turn back to God and... wouldn't you know it, a few years later, it's the same thing again. The world, if it's left to its own devices, turns rotten. The world manifests a tendency to deteriorate on its own. And what God is calling us to do, what Jesus is saying that we are in relation to this, is to stop it from that. I don't think Jesus' point here is that the world is bland and Christians liven it up some by being a little bit of seasoning so that it's ultimately, because of the seasoning that we bring to the world, that it's palatable to God. He likes its taste because of the righteousness that we bring. Well, there is an element of salt in that, and Paul uses that kind of metaphor as he talks about our speech being seasoned. But I think what Jesus is driving at mostly is that the world is decaying and we have to stop it from decaying. We are the preservative. We are the salt of the world. That was the main use of salt, to prevent decay. And it's still used in that role in some places and in some situations. But what's surprising about this, perhaps, is that of all the power of God, all the things that He could do, in His wisdom, what He has chosen as the most powerful of all restraints within sinful society is His people. He could have come up with any other way imaginable to stop the decay of sin in society. And what He says that He will use to prevent that are His followers, the citizens of His kingdom. He doesn't come down and say, you need to enact laws. He doesn't come down and say, you need to start a political reform, start a political kingdom, elect a Christian president to run the nation right. He says, you people go live your lives the way you're supposed to live your lives. And people will see that. And the decay of sin will be slowed because of that. But he says the salt can lose its flavor, and at that point it becomes worthless. What this means is that although we are in the world, we must not be of the world. We can't be like the world. We can't become worldly. The savor of salt, the saltiness of salt, lies in its distinctiveness, in being different from what is around it. And this kind of is the other side of the irony of this, that as Jesus initially widens this gap between the kingdom citizen and the rest of the world, and now He brings us back into relationship with them in this way, here again what He says is, you can't be like them, you must be different from them. The only hope that you have to stop the decay of sin is to be distinct from the world, to be different from the world. And it's only that in being different that we can be that influence. It's the kind of character that is depicted in the Beatitudes. As disciples of Christ, we illustrate that in word and deed. Now, technically speaking, if I understand correctly, salt is never unsalty. Once you have the chemical composition of salt and it is correct, no matter what you do to it, it will always taste salty. But that's not Jesus' point, really. Again, this isn't about seasoning, I don't think. Salt can, if it is polluted, as salty as it may be, it is worthless as a preservative. It's as useless as road dust is. And so Jesus says, if it's not salty anymore, it's not good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. And what a tremendous fall that is for us if that is our lot. Here we have been called to be saviors to society, to prevent the world from decay, and yet we wind up supplying material for footpaths. No, we must remain distinct. We must be different from the world. If we become assimilated to non-Christians, if we become contaminated by the impurities of the world, we lose our influence, and ultimately we will decay with them instead of stopping them from decay. Jesus goes on to say, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." You are the light of the world, Jesus says. And as he says this, he compares this to light in the ancient world. And one of the things that is true of light, especially light in a non-electric culture like they lived in, is that it was absolutely impossible to hide light. You see a city that is up on a hill in the distance, and you can't miss it. There's nothing that can be done to hide the light from that city. And that was true when all they had were candles and lanterns. Imagine approaching one of today's cities in the dark. It is impossible to hide. The light fills the sky. It reflects off the clouds. It's absolutely impossible to miss because it is so different from the darkness that surrounds it. If we are the light of the world, our influence is one that is impossible to hide. People can't help but see us as different from the world if we are as different as light is from darkness. And not only is it an influence that is impossible to hide, light was a blessing that was unthinkable to hide. Light was so important. And again, I think we take it for granted because it's so easy for us to get light in today's culture. But light was so important that it was ludicrous to think that anyone would want to put it out or anyone would want to hide its flame. Notice Jesus doesn't begin here by saying, you people need to go let your light shine. He gets to that point. He does ultimately say, let your light shine before men. But what he begins by saying is, listen, we all understand how important light is, that it's absolutely unthinkable to try to put it out. Nobody does this. No one hides their light. No one puts a basket over it. No one does any of these things because it's unthinkable to do something with such a blessing. No, what you do with light is you put it out in the open where it will do the most good for the most people. That's what you do with light. And doing anything else is absolutely absurd. Well, is that what we do with the light that we have? We can't conceal the truth that we know or the truth of what we are. We can't pretend to be other than what we are. We must make ourselves as visible as possible in all the fullness of our Christian faith. Because ultimately, a Christian who hides himself isn't following Christ. Well, what exactly is this light? I mean, here Jesus says that we are the light of the world. And later on, he'll say that he's the light of the world. And if you turn to 1 John chapter 1, in a passage that I think illuminates this text a little bit, we find John saying that God is light. Well, what exactly is this light? Well, first let me suggest to you that this light that we are is a light by derivation. That is to say that it is not our own light, that we derive this light from another source. In 1 John chapter 1 and verse 5, John says, "This is the message we have heard from him and proclaimed to you, that God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. If we have fellowship with him while we walk in the darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus his Son cleanses us from all sin." I don't think Jesus is saying back here in the Sermon on the Mount that we are so filled up with some inherent goodness, that there is some just overwhelming light flowing out from within us because of such righteous and holy people that we are, that the world will see us. No, I think the point is that we take the character of Christ, we pattern ourselves after the life of Christ, and we reflect His light into the world. The terminology that John uses is that we walk in the light. It's perhaps very much like the way that the moon travels in the light of the sun and shines light on the world by reflecting that light to the earth. So also we walk in the path of the sun and we reflect his light to the world. And ultimately we know that it's not our own light, because what the people do when they see the light that we shine is not glorify us, but they glorify God. They realize that it's by His grace that we are who we are. That our light is really His light. And they don't praise the lamp that bears the light. They praise the light itself. So first I would suggest to you that the light that we shine is not our own. It is God's light. And secondly, we see here that at least in some way, the light that we shine is shown by our good works. This is what they will see. It is the visible manifestation of our faith. It's the things that we do. It's the things that we say. I don't know that Jesus has anything specific in mind here necessarily, as much as it is every outward manifestation of our faith. Any visible act that shows that we are His followers. Perhaps the context suggests that when we live by the Beatitudes, that when we are meek people, when we are merciful people, that when we bring people the peace of Christ, when we mourn over sin and recognize our spiritual bankruptcy, that it is then that we shine our light. And one other way that may be in mind of shining our light is perhaps in referring to speaking the truth to people. Because light in the Bible is regularly a symbol of the truth. When God says in the Old Testament that Israel was to be a light to the nations, it meant the nations would come to learn the truth of who God was. When Paul stands before Agrippa in Acts 26 and speaks of the light that he brings, what he means is he is teaching the truth. When Simeon speaks in Luke chapter 2 of the light that is revealed, it is the same thing, the truth being brought. Not just the light itself. And so maybe then also in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is suggesting that it's not just passive living, not just being a good example in what we do, but in speaking the truth in what we say, actively teaching people about Christ. Well, what do we do with this? Let me suggest to you a few applications that we can make from this text. Nothing I don't think that we haven't already said, but perhaps to just hone it down and make it a little bit more specific here at the end. Well, first of all, I think we need to remember, and that this passage teaches very clearly, that there is a fundamental difference between Christians and non-Christians. There is a fundamental difference between the church and the world. And we must be different from the world. We said at the outset, Jesus is changing his focus by bringing us back into relation with the world here. And be that as it may, we still must be different from the world. And we can't just be a little different from the world. We must be as different from the world as light is from darkness. We must be as different from the world as salt is from rottenness. And we serve neither God nor ourselves by trying to minimize that difference. We said at the outset of the series of lessons that the Sermon on the Mount is built on the assumption that Christians are different. and Christians are called to be different. It's rooted in the Old Testament teaching where Moses tells the people and God tells them constantly through the prophets that you are to be different from the nations. You're not to be like all the people around you. And constantly we see them falling prey to that very thing where they say, we want to be like the people around us. We want to have a king. We want to have idols like the people around us. And God saying ultimately, you're punished because of this very thing. And you see the same thing in this sermon. Really, it's the subtext of everything that Jesus says. But at various times, he makes it explicit. You're not to be like the Pharisees. You're to be more righteous than they are. You're not to pray like they pray. You're not to give alms like they give alms. Don't be like the Jewish religious leaders. And don't be like the Gentiles either. You know how they are. You know how they pray. You know how they worry. Don't be like them. The constant teaching in this sermon is that you must be different. And over the history of the church, the great tragedy is the same as the great tragedy of Israel. It's that we too often conform to the prevailing culture. We too often are like the people around us. We lose our saltiness. Our light dims into darkness, and the world decays away. Because we're not being the people that we should be. Really, this puts a great responsibility on us. What Jesus says here isn't something that you can read right over and forget about and go your merry way. Jesus is laying a burden on our backs when he says that we are the salt of the earth and we are the light of the world. And we must accept this responsibility. Each of these sentences begins with the word you, which in the Greek, if I understand, is not the common way of starting one of these sentences. And it suggests that Jesus is emphatically making a point that this is your responsibility and no one else's responsibility. And so you must not fail the world that you've been called to serve. You must be what you have been called to be. Because no one else is going to do it. And ultimately, this means that we have to come in contact with the world. Salt that never leaves the salt shaker is useless to everything else. It can't prevent decay. There's nothing distinct about it. It must come into direct contact with the meat that is subject to decay in order to serve its purpose. Practically speaking, what this means is that we must be overtly Christian when we are outside of this building. We must display a Christ-like character when we are in the world by not being of the world. John Stott said in his little book on the Sermon on the Mount, "Christian salt has no business to remain snugly in elegant little ecclesiastical salt cellars. Our place is to be rubbed into the secular community as salt is rubbed into meat to stop it from going bad." And when society does go bad, we Christians tend to throw up our hands in pious horror and reproach the non-Christian world. But should we not rather reproach ourselves? One can hardly blame unsalted meat for going bad. It cannot do anything else. The real question to ask is, where is the salt? Understand, the world is decaying and the world is going to decay. The path that leads to destruction is wide. But if we are not out staving off the rot that we can by being salt, the blame is not on the unsalted meat. The only thing it can do is rot. We must be the people we have been called to be. We must accept this responsibility. We must, as even our Master did, associate with the very ones who are the most subject to decay. Because it is only by doing that that we can save them from that. And really, in being called to be salt and light, there are two different aspects of this obligation, and we have to understand what both sides of that are. There's a positive side as well as the negative side. Our Christian responsibility is twofold in this way. It's the function of salt. You may think of it as more of a negative sort of function. It is to prevent decay. It is to stop the rot. The function of light, however, is largely positive. It illuminates the darkness. It brings light to a dark place. Our job's not just to stop the spread of evil, to be salt. It's also to promote the spread of truth, to be light. Yes, there is a point where Christians must condemn evil. There's a point where we must stand up and say, no, this is wrong. We must stop doing this kind of thing. And our society is going the wrong direction, and we must stop sinning. And in that way, be salt. Put up these barricades against sin. But understand that society needs more than barricades against sin. Barricades against sin are great for what they are. Telling people sin is great for what it is. But that's not the end of the matter. Society needs more than barricades. It needs regeneration. It needs new life. And that only comes by positively teaching the truth, not just negatively teaching against sin. And both of these roles are equally important. And ultimately, when you look at this in the context of the Sermon on the Mount, I think what Jesus is saying is that the way that we show that we are salt, the way that we show that we are light, is by the character. It's rooted in the way that we live. We succeed in doing this by the character that we have. This ultimately is built out of these Beatitudes. This plain, simple moral teaching about the kind of character traits citizens of God's kingdom should have. Jesus will teach it in John's gospel as love. What he says there is, by this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. Notice Jesus doesn't say that we show our distinctiveness from the rest of the world by not having a piano in the church building. We don't show our distinctiveness for the rest of the world by taking the Lord's Supper every first day of the week, or having the right name on the sign, or any of the other things that we take such great, dare I say, pride in having. Those things are important, don't get me wrong. Following God's law is absolutely important, but rigid obedience to regulations, even though that is important, won't bring most lost men to glorify God. That's not how they come to see who God is. It's by loving one another and loving them. The obedience to the regulations will come at a later point. Imagine someone came this morning, a visitor who knew nothing about God and nothing about Christ. And they showed up 15 minutes early and spent 2 hours with us this morning and stayed around 15 minutes afterwards talking with us. And came back tonight and spent another 15 minutes before and after in the assembly with us, so that all in all, they spent 4 hours with us today. If they spend that time with us, they're going to notice that there are things different about what we do and who we are. They're going to notice that there's not a piano in this church building, whereas in most church buildings there are. They're going to notice that here it is, the middle of September, no special reason, we took the Lord's Supper, and a lot of places in the world wouldn't have. But what do they walk away from this assembly with? Let me suggest to you that if they walk away thinking, boy, that was weird, they didn't have a piano, then they're going to walk away thinking that we're just another odd denomination. And brothers and sisters, if they spend 4 hours with us and that's all they walk away with, then they're probably right. Should they not walk away thinking, those people are different? Those people love God. Those people love each other. Those people care about me and I don't even know them. Those people are willing to sacrifice of themselves for each other and for me. Yeah, they're going to notice the things that are different, but is that what they get out of being with us? If they walk away noticing our love, then they will walk away thinking those are Christ's people. and I'd like to know more about this Jesus they serve. That's how we are salt. That's how we are light. It's by the love that we show each other. It's by the love that we show our neighbor. It's by the love that we show our enemies. It's by the sacrificial lives that we live. It's by the things that we say to the people of the world, as our speech is seasoned with grace, seasoned with salt. And ultimately, the results of living this kind of life really is evident throughout this entire text. If you go back to the beginning of this sermon, Jesus says, "You live this kind of life, you will be blessed." And that's what he says over and over and over. You will be blessed if you live this life. And then we see that in addition to us being blessed, the world is served by us living this kind of life. We do something to stop the decay of sin. We do something to illuminate the world to the knowledge of Christ. So we are blessed and the world is served. But most importantly, God is glorified. And this really is what it's all about. It's the same thing that Paul says in the beginning of the book of Ephesians, that we've been blessed with every blessing imaginable, and ultimately as he works his way through that text, he gets to the end and says the entire purpose of this is for us to turn around and glorify God. That's the same thing Jesus says here. We are blessed by living this kind of life, and ultimately people will glorify God because of that. But we have a calling if we want to receive this blessing and we want to one day eternally glorify God. And that is to be salt. And that is to be light. And so we sing this song really asking this very question. Won't you tell somebody about this? Or perhaps you've heard this for the first time, or you've heard something that has pricked your conscience in such a way that you feel the need to speak to a brother, to ask for the prayers of the saints, or whatever the case may be. If there's some way that we can help you this evening, won't you come while we stand and sing?